Murphy's hands were loaded with coffee and cinnamon rolls, and he was trying not to drop anything. Only as he neared Dr. Anderson did he notice that something was wrong. The old man's eyes were wide, and his mouth was gaping open as he stared at something behind Murphy that terrified him. Murphy's martial arts training instantly kicked into gear. Dropping the coffee and rolls, he leaped forward, trying to grab for the doctor. As their hands touched, he could hear the roar of the SUV closing in at great speed. Murphy tried to jump to the side and pull Dr. Anderson with him, but it was too late. He could feel the doctor being ripped from his grip as the left front fender of the SUV hit the old man and sent him flying in the air. Murphy had moved just far enough away that he bounced off the side of the SUV and rolled away, dazed but alive. Talon, not bothering to get out of the SUV, believed he had accomplished his task. Pleased, he stepped on the gas and disappeared around a corner. Murphy pulled himself together and limped over to Dr. Anderson. He seemed to still be breathing, but it was shallow.
"Doctor! Doctor! Hang on! I'll get some help!"
A feeble hand reached up. Murphy bent until his ear was close to the doctor's mouth.
"The key... around my neck," Dr. Anderson whispered.
Murphy could see a chain around the old man's neck. Blood was oozing out over it.
"I want to be like the thief on the cross," Dr. Anderson murmured, before his eyes fluttered closed one last time.
Chapter 17. Murphy knew that Levy Abrams was a complicated man. He had been born in Israel and had gone to college in the United States. Then, immediately upon graduation, he had joined the Israeli army. Tall and muscular, he soon came to the attention of Mossad, Israel's Institute for Intelligence and Special Operations. The group recruited Abrams for top-secret work. Murphy could never get him to talk about what he had done during his years with Mossad. Although Abrams said that he had retired from Mossad and was now living in the United States, Murphy wasn't too sure. He was too well connected in the Middle East and Arab countries, and he knew too much about current covert operations. Murphy believed that Abrams' job as a security expert for a high-tech company in the Raleigh-Durham area was just a cover. Levy might have just the information Murphy needed, so Murphy phoned his old friend.
"How are you, Michael? I heard about your wrestling match with an SUV," Abrams said as soon as he got on the line.
"How did you hear about that?"
"You'd be surprised what I know, Michael. But if I told you, you know I'd have to kill you."
Abrams' grin could be heard in his voice.
Murphy laughed. "I think you'd have a difficult time. I've learned some new karate moves."
"You sound a little cocky for someone who barely escaped with his life. Don't forget you're talking to the master teacher."
"Oh, I beg your pardon, O Great One. Is it possible for a lowly student to get some time with the great master?"
"What's on your mind, Michael? Does the name Methuselah ring any bells? What does that old buzzard want now?"
"I think he's given me a clue to another biblical artifact, the handwriting on the wall, the one written on Nebuchadnezzar's wall by the hand of God."
"You've got to be kidding, Michael. Do you really trust Methuselah?"
"Not very far, but he has led us to some great finds in the past.
So, how can I help?"
"I need you to pull some strings and help me get back into Iraq. I have to go to Babylon, and you have all the connections."
There was a pause.
"Are you serious, Michael? I think you have a death wish. There may not be SUVs trying to run you down, but there are roadside bombs, random mortar attacks, and kidnappings. Do you want to lose your head to a sword?"
Ignoring Abrams' question, Murphy continued, "I'm planning to take ISIS with me. She's going to contact the Parchments of Freedom Foundation to see if they'll fund the trip like they did for the Ararat expedition. There's a good chance that they will."
"Oh, great. Now you're going to take a beautiful red-headed American woman with you. Do you think she won't attract attention? I think you hit your head in your last adventure. Iraq is not the safest place for civilians."
"Could we at least get together to discuss it?
When were you thinking about going?
Within a month or two. I'm going to fly up to New York on some business. ISIS is going to fly up from D.C., and we're going to go over the details.
Maybe we could get together in New York. Some friends have asked me to attend to certain matters there.
Friends?
There was another pause.
Michael, let's just say that they need some information to make effective business decisions.
Chapter 18. Eugene Simpson glanced at his watch as he pulled up next to the Gulfstream IV jet. With a sigh of relief, he shifted the polished ebony Mercedes into park and got out.
Whew, just on time.
He had worked for Barrington Communications for 3 years and had been late only once. One mistake is all any employee ever had with Shane Barrington, one of the richest and most powerful men in the world. As Simpson opened the back door, he looked into Barrington's flint gray eyes. It gave him the chills. He quickly stepped back and stood at attention like a trained soldier. The athletic frame of the cold-hearted corporate warrior emerged. He straightened the coat of his $2,500 suit and looked around. The soft gray hair at his temples whipped around in the slight breeze. Simpson looked at his employer's high cheekbones and thin lips. His large body and confident stance were very imposing.
"Get the bags, Eugene."
It was slightly overcast when the jet put down in Zurich. The damp, dark weather matched Barrington's spirit. He was not happy at being there. He was getting a little tired of being ordered around by 7 pompous, smug, power-hungry egomaniacs. He'd about had his fill.
"Careful, Barrington. They've helped to make you rich and can destroy you, too. They do control your purse strings, you know, at least for now."
He felt his chest and stomach muscles tighten when the chauffeur drove up to take him to the castle.
"Why do they always send that creepy driver who has no tongue? Oh well, at least I don't have to listen to him jabber."
In about 15 minutes, the limousine broke through the low clouds. The sky was blue, and the sun shone on the snow-covered Alps. It took about another hour before Barrington could see the Gothic spires of the castle in the distance. They didn't look quite as foreboding as the last time he was here.
"Maybe I'm getting used to it," he told himself. "If it wasn't for those egomaniacs, this would be a beautiful place to visit."
The chauffeur let Barrington off in front of the giant wooden door. Inside the large entry hall, he walked past suits of armor standing like lifeless sentries for some medieval king. Torches that usually burned brightly were out. The whole place seemed eerie and uninviting, deserted. His footsteps echoed loudly on the stone floors. By now he knew the routine. He strode to the large stainless steel door at the south end of the hall, which hissed open to allow him to enter, then hissed shut. He pushed the down button.
"All aboard. First stop, hell."
It had been hell, all right. Especially the night he first met Talon, as his son Arthur lay on a bed with a breathing mask over his face. He recalled the conversation.
"Talon, what kind of name is that? A first name or a last name?"
He could hear the South African accent like it was yesterday.
"It makes no difference. I use it because it is a tribute to the only serious wound I have ever gotten in my life as a warrior. The first falcon I raised and trained as a boy in South Africa, the last thing I allowed myself to grow attached to, turned on me one day and ripped my index finger off my hand."
Barrington remembered Talon removing the glove of his right hand and displaying what looked like a flesh-colored finger, except where the fingertip should have a nail, the whole tip was honed to a sharp point. The artificial finger was in reality a deadly killing weapon, and Talon used his finger of death quite effectively. Even as hardened as Barrington was, he shuddered as he remembered Talon using his finger to cut the breathing tube that fed life-giving air to his son, Arthur. Barrington watched silently as his son slowly suffocated to death. He really didn't love the boy, but he was angry with himself.
"Why didn't I try to stop Talon? It was cold-blooded murder, and I did nothing to stop it."
He could feel his fists clenching tightly as the elevator came to a stop and the door hissed open. Barrington's attention shifted to the ornately carved wooden chair in the center of the darkened room. A light came down from the ceiling and lit it up. He could see the gargoyles on the arms. He remembered grabbing them on other occasions.
"Well, let's get this over. Time to take the hot seat."
He sat down in the chair and looked at the long table in front of him, covered with the blood-red cloth. No one was seated in the seven chairs behind the table. In the ominous silence, Barrington could hear his own heartbeat.
"This is like going to the principal's office in high school. They make you sit outside and sweat for a while before they talk to you. I know their game."
10 minutes passed before the seven entered and took their places.
"Not very brave. They shine lights in my face so I can't make out who they are. But someday I'll find out. Then we'll see how brave they are."
John Bartholomew was the first to speak.
"You're a little late, Mr. Barrington. Do we need to buy you a Swiss watch?"
The sarcastic tone inflamed Barrington.
"Just smile and ignore it." "That might be a good idea. Do you know where I can get one?"
"Are we a little testy today, Mr. Barrington?"
Barrington knew he had better cut out the sarcasm. He was on their turf, and they had the power, this time. He was forming his response when General Lee spoke.
"Yes, we are very concerned. What was Dr. Murphy doing in Orlando with a Dr. Harley B. Anderson? Our messenger failed to dispatch both of them, and we are quite disturbed."
The voice of a German woman broke in.
"We want you to find out more information about this Dr. Michael Murphy. We are not satisfied with what we are getting. What are your plans for procuring this information for us?"
Barrington knew he really was in the hot seat.
"I have one of my best investigative reporters following up on Dr. Murphy right now."
"Is that a fact, Mr. Barrington?" came the smooth response of Señor Mendez. "Would that reporter happen to be Stephanie Kovacs?"
"How do these people get all this information?" Barrington thought angrily.
Mendez continued silkily.
"Isn't she also your living lover?"
The man's voice had an unmistakable smirk in it. Barrington was desperately trying to think how to respond when Sir William Merton spoke up.
"Can you trust her, Mr. Barrington? We do not have much patience with those who are not loyal," he said, stroking his clerical collar.
Barrington bristled. He didn't like being threatened by anyone, especially by people who hid in the dark. His hands gripped the gargoyles tightly as he said icily,
"I can trust her. She always pursues a story to the end. I also have a student in one of Murphy's classes working for me, Paul Wallach. Between these two people, I think you will get the information you need."
"You had better hope so, Mr. Barrington. Your health depends on it,"
Bartholomew stated firmly.
"If someone had talked to me that way when I lived on the streets of Detroit, they wouldn't still be standing,"
Barrington swore silently.
"Our recommendation is that you watch her very carefully. Are we clear about this?"
Barrington clenched his teeth tighter.
"I didn't hear your response, Mr. Barrington."
Now it had come to a push-and-shove game. The seven were testing him as to who was in control and who had the power.
"I understand."
"What did you say, Mr. Barrington? I couldn't hear you,"
Bartholomew repeated. It was plain to see that they not only wanted submission, but they also wanted to humiliate him.
"I said I understand."
"Well, it's nice to have you on board. And by the way, next time, don't be late."
Barrington bit his tongue. His mind was racing as he got up and left.
"Who do these people think they are, having me fly all the way across the Atlantic for a short meeting like this? They could have phoned the same information. They just want to let me know who is in control. I don't know how much more of this I'm going to take."
Chapter 19. Murphy glanced at his watch.
9:10. You'd better get going."
He finished his last sip of coffee and tossed the cup into a trash container. Then he got up, stretched, gathered his notes, and took a deep breath. The scent of magnolias filled the air. This quiet spot on campus was a haven to think and pray before his classes started. Many of the students were already seated when he entered the lecture hall. Murphy walked down the stairs to the platform and opened his briefcase. Then he took out his notes and glanced around the room. Sherry was talking with two students on one side of the room. Paul Wallach was seated on the other side.
"I guess they're still having problems," he thought.
A number of students were gathered in a group toward the back.
"Please take your seats," Murphy announced. "We're going to begin."
As the group began to split up, he saw that they had been gathered around Stephanie Kovacs.
"Three lectures in a row. I wonder why she's spending so much time at Preston and in my class."
"Good morning, class. Today, we're going to continue our historical look at the great city of Babylon. We have already seen that it was a huge city with majestic buildings, paved streets, drainage systems, and a vast network of irrigation canals. The dimensions of the largest canal can still be traced. It left the Euphrates at Hit and skirted the desert and ran southeast for over 400 miles to the Persian Gulf, where it emptied into the Bay of Grain. Over the years, the city has been ruled by a number of great leaders, including Hammurabi, Nebuchadnezzar, Cyrus the Great, and Alexander the Great. In 539 BC, the Persians captured Babylon. Later, King Xerxes I of Persia destroyed part of the city. From that point on, the great city of Babylon began to decline. The writer Dio comments that when Trajan visited Babylon in AD 116, he saw nothing but mound and stones and ruins. Murphy could see a little bit of a glassy stare as the class began to swim in historical details.
"Maybe this will recapture their attention," he thought with a grin.
"Does the name Saddam Hussein ring any bells with you? Are you aware that Saddam began the rebuilding of the city of Babylon in the early 1980s?
Murphy turned on the PowerPoint projector. Slides of many new buildings and huge walls were projected at the front of the room.
"This next slide is a quote from Saddam Hussein given in 1979.
The slide read,
"What is most important to me about Nebuchadnezzar is the link between the Arabs' abilities and the liberation of Palestine. Nebuchadnezzar was, after all, an Arab from Iraq, albeit ancient Iraq. Nebuchadnezzar was the one who brought the bound Jewish slaves from Palestine. That is why, whenever I remember Nebuchadnezzar, I like to remind the Arabs, Iraqis in particular, of their historical responsibilities. It is a burden that should not stop them from action, but rather spur them into action because of their history."
Saddam Hussein, 1979, quoted by David Lam in the Los Angeles Times.
Before the war in Iraq and the capture of Saddam Hussein, he had three overriding goals: gaining territory, gaining economic power, and eliminating Israel as a nation. Although he will now never be able to accomplish these objectives, we need to keep our eyes on Iraq and the city of Babylon.
Murphy could see that he had again caught the students' attention.
In the Bible, the book of Revelation contains over 404 verses. In chapters 17 and 18, there are 42 verses that deal with what I believe is the literal rebuilt city of Babylon. When you add Revelation 14:8 and 16:19, which discuss Babylon's future, you have 44 verses talking about this city. In other words, it is important enough that 10% of the book of Revelation speaks of the fate of Babylon.
"Dr. Murphy, why do you think that Babylon is so important?" Paul Wallach asked.
"That's the first time Paul has spoken up in a long time. I'm glad he finally decided to participate."
"That's a good question, Paul. I think it is important because Babylon was the first city where organized rebellion against God took place. We find that in Genesis chapter 11. Babylon was the capital city of the first world ruler, Nimrod. He was also the king of Babylon, as was Nebuchadnezzar, who destroyed the city of Jerusalem and the temple in 586 BC. Babylon was the city from which four Gentile empires ruled over Jerusalem.
Murphy brought up the next slide on the projector. Another reason I believe it is important is found in Revelation 17:5. Look at some pretty strong words from the Apostle John. The next slide. Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. Revelation 17:5. The great historian Arnold Toynbee suggested to his readers that Babylon would be the best place in the world to build a future world cultural metropolis. In fact, there are some who believe that not only will Babylon be a cultural center, but it will become an economic center as well. According to Bible prophecy, that center will house the one world government, one world religion, and one world commerce. Wallach raised his hand again. Why do they think that Babylon is that important? I think there are a couple of reasons, Paul. An obvious answer is that it is in the center of much of the world's oil production. Oil is one of the driving economic factors for all countries. Another reason would be to help rebuild Iraq in such a way as to placate and ease the tensions in the Arab world. The hope might be to take on a more tolerant view of the various radical groups in the Muslim cultures. In this way, they might hope to decrease terrorist activities. However, I don't think a renewal of Babylon will accomplish the desired goal. Murphy could see that, by now, even Stephanie Kovacs was taking notes. Let me come back to the thoughts about Babylon becoming an economic center. For the past few decades, we have witnessed the rise of what is called the European Union. This is a family of democratic European countries that have banded together for the purpose of peace and prosperity. It was initially made up of only six countries: Belgium, Germany, France, Italy, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands. Later, they were joined by Denmark, Ireland, and the United Kingdom. Greece joined the group in 1981, and Spain and Portugal in 1986. They were followed by Austria, Finland, and Sweden. Even more countries have applied for membership. Some have referred to this union as the United States of Europe. The European Union is growing and needs large supplies of oil. For that oil, the member nations are beginning to turn their focus toward the Arab countries. Murphy clicked up another slide. You will notice on this next slide two mottos or slogans. Note the difference between them. This has a lot to do with philosophy and focus. The next slide. United States of America, United We Stand. European Union, Unity in Diversity. By uniting together, members of the European Union have raised the standard of living for Europeans during the last half century. They have been fostering cooperation among the member nations while still promoting diversity. One of the ways they've united is by the establishment of a new monetary system utilizing what is called the euro. This has strengthened Europe's voice in the world's marketplace. In fact, the euro is more stable and valuable than the U.S. dollar. The United States is operating with a $435 billion trade deficit. The European Union, however, can boast a $26 billion trade surplus. Together, the member nations have a 14% larger economy than the United States. The next slide shows what has already been established by the European Union. The next slide. European Union, European Parliament, Council of the European Union, European Commission, Court of Justice, Court of Auditors, European Economic and Social Committee, Committee of the Regions, European Central Bank, European Ombudsman, European Investment Bank, Europe Day, May 9. The motto, Unity and Diversity, is symbolized by a woman riding the back of a large bull. She is holding a flag with 10 stars in a circle. The 10 stars represent the original 10 countries that founded the Union. Also, riding on the back of the bull are smaller people all waving the flags of various member nations. What does that symbolize? Don West asked. It comes from Greek mythology, Don. According to the legend, Mother Earth and Father Heaven had 2 children named Cronus and Rhea. Cronus and Rhea produced a son by the name of Zeus. As the story goes, Zeus was watching a young maiden named Europa playing and talking with her girlfriends.
It doesn't sound like much has changed, said Clayton Anderson. We're still watching the girls.
The students whistled and catcalled.
I guess you're the expert, Clayton, Murphy replied to the amusement of the class.
If I may continue, Cupid shot one of his arrows into Zeus, and he fell in love with Europa. He transformed himself into a handsome bull of chestnut color with a silver circle on his brow and horns like a crescent moon. Europa and her girlfriends walked up to the bull and petted it. Europa said, I bet I could ride the creature. It looked so calm and gentle. That was her mistake. When she sat on the bull, it got up and ran across the ocean. Europa held on for dear life. Later, Zeus married Europa, and they lived on the island of Crete. Their sons became very famous and powerful. Although their names are forgotten, hers is not. It is believed that the continent of Europe was named after Europa. The maiden riding a beast is a reminder of Zeus and Europa. It foreshadows the birth of a continent that will become very famous, powerful, and influential. As Murphy punched up the next slide, the bell rang. Hold on a minute, gang. I want to give you a reading assignment for the next session. There were audible groans from all over the lecture hall. I want you to read chapter 2 of the Book of Daniel. It talks about Nebuchadnezzar's dream of a large statue. I think it will help to clarify some issues about the European Union and coming future events.
Chapter 20. As the students were making their way out of the lecture hall, Stephanie Kovacs walked down the steps to the platform where Murphy was putting away his notes.
Good morning, Stephanie. I was surprised to see you again.
I was still in town, Dr. Murphy, and I thought I'd catch your lecture again. I enjoyed it. You have some thought-provoking ideas. Do you really think that Babylon will develop into an economic and cultural center?
As a matter of fact, I do. I think it will rise to prominence once again as part of fulfilling the various prophecies in the Bible.
I'm afraid that I'm not well-versed in the Bible, let alone in any prophecies. Can you give me an example of what you're talking about?
Murphy reached into his briefcase and pulled out his Bible. Let me read you a passage from the book of Revelation, chapter 18, beginning at verse 9. It's talking about how people around the world will mourn the fall of Babylon. The kings of the earth who committed fornication and lived luxuriously with her will weep and lament for her when they see the smoke of her burning standing at a distance for fear of her torment, saying, Alas, alas, the great city of Babylon, that mighty city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come. And the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her, for no one buys their merchandise any more, merchandise of gold and silver, precious stones and pearls, fine linen and purple, silk and scarlet, every kind of citron wood, every kind of object of ivory, every kind of object and most precious wood, bronze, iron, and marble, and cinnamon and incense, fragrant oil and frankincense, wine and oil, fine flour and wheat, cattle and sheep, horses and chariots, and bodies and souls of men. The fruit that your soul longed for has gone from you, and all the things which are rich and splendid have gone from you, and you shall find them no more at all. The merchants of these things, who became rich by her, will stand at a distance for fear of her torment, weeping and wailing, and saying, Alas, alas, that great city that was clothed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, for in 1 hour such great riches came to nothing. Every shipmaster, all who travel by ship, sailors, and as many as trade on the sea, stood at a distance and cried out when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, What is like this great city? This prophecy was written by the Apostle John in A.D. 95, after Babylon had already fallen into ruins. He was talking about a future destruction that will come to pass. This is especially interesting since Saddam started the rebuilding of Babylon.
I was fascinated by the symbol of the woman riding the bull as a symbol of the European Union. Do you have any other information about that?
Why don't you come to my next lecture and find out?
I wish I could, but I'll be out of town, Kovacs responded.
Well, let's go over to the student center and get a cup of coffee, and I'll fill you in. Do you have the time?
Sure. Maybe this time I'll be able to tell him.
Kovacs took a sip of coffee and looked around at the students sitting at tables, laughing and flirting with each other.
Those were innocent days. How I wish I could return to them.
Where would you like to begin? Murphy asked.
Do you mind if I take a few notes?
Be my guest.
Tell me about this statue. I don't understand it.
Well, it started when King Nebuchadnezzar had a dream about a large statue that had a head of gold, a chest of silver, a body of bronze, legs of iron, and feet of iron and clay mixed together. He couldn't understand this image.
Neither do I.
Daniel informed the king that the golden head represented his kingdom and power. The chest and arms of silver stood for the kingdom that was to follow Nebuchadnezzar's. It wouldn't be as strong and influential as his was. That was the Medo-Persian Empire. It would be followed by the Greek Empire, represented by the bronze body. The two legs of iron stood for the Roman Empire, which broke into two sections. The feet of iron and clay mixed together illustrated 10 kingdoms that were to come.
Nebuchadnezzar must have had a bad pizza that night. Murphy laughed and nodded.
Many Bible scholars believe that the 10 toes of the image represent 10 kingdoms of the revived Roman Empire. They think that they will arise out of the European Union.
Didn't you mention that there were more than 10 countries in the European Union?
Yes, there are more right now. Many people feel that there are other possibilities as to what those 10 toes represent. Some think that there will eventually be a merging of several countries together. Others think that the 10 toes represent 10 regions of world commerce. That's probably the most plausible explanation.
By regions, what do you mean? Kovacs got her pen ready.
It has been suggested that the regions are Europe, the Far East, the Mideast, North America, South America, South Asia, Central Asia, Australia, and New Zealand, Southern Africa, and Central Africa. Of course, only time will tell. But right now, we can see the rise of Europe. It's becoming more and more powerful and is beginning to have a stronger voice in world affairs.
I've heard it said that what the world needs is a world leader, someone who can bring about peace. Do you believe that this will one day happen?
Most certainly. The Bible calls him the Antichrist. Some people think he may be alive today. He'll unite the nations at first and seem to bring about peace. However, that's just a ploy. He'll soon become a dictator and take control, economically, socially, and spiritually.
You mean like a Hitler or Stalin or Mao Zedong?
I think he'll be much worse, Murphy said soberly. The Bible also talks about a rapture, where the believers in God are taken out of the world before a final world war called the Battle of Armageddon. Those who don't believe in God will be left behind to go through a period of great tribulation.
Yes, I've heard that discussed before. It all sounds pretty scary, Kovacs replied, and pretty unbelievable, like a novel.
Doesn't have to be, Murphy told her.
What do you mean? Kovacs looked puzzled.
Well, people don't have to be left behind. All they need to do is ask Christ to come into their lives and change them from the inside out. Stephanie, do you remember the last time we talked, I used an illustration about a kite and how God speaks to us through our conscience and through the Bible? Another illustration comes out of the book of Revelation. It is found in the 3rd chapter in the 20th verse. It says, "Look, I have been standing at the door, and I am constantly knocking. If anyone hears me calling him and opens the door, I will come in and fellowship with him and he with me." It's a picture of Christ standing at the door of your heart. He would like to come in, but he's a gentleman. He won't force his way in. He just patiently knocks and waits for the door to open. He keeps calling and hoping that his still, small voice will be heard. He knocks at everyone's heart's door. It is sort of like the pull of the string on the kite. Stephanie, do you hear him knocking at your heart's door? Murphy stopped talking. Kovacs waited a minute before she said,
I'm afraid, Dr. Murphy.
Afraid of what, Stephanie?
Afraid of the changes I would have to make in my lifestyle.
Murphy nodded. I know, it may not be easy, but God will give you the strength.
I'm still scared. I don't think I'm ready for that.
That's okay. God has plenty of time. You can open your heart's door to Him when you are ready. It doesn't have to be in a church or with anyone else present. You can do it when you are all alone. All you have to do is pray a little prayer to Him. Something like this. God, I realize that I am a sinner and I have done wrong. I believe that You died on the cross to pay the penalty for my sins. I believe that You rose from the dead to create a new life for me. I would like to experience that new life. Please forgive me. I want to follow You. Please change my life. Please help me to learn to live for You. Thank You for doing this for me. Amen. Stephanie was staring off into space. Let me write out a verse for you that I've found helpful. You can memorize it. Murphy wrote out the verse and handed it to Kovacs. They talked about it for a few minutes. Then Don West came up to their table.
Excuse me, Dr. Murphy. I saw Sherry Nelson a few minutes ago. She said if I saw you around campus to let you know that you had an important message in your office.
Thank you, Don. Murphy turned back to Stephanie. If you'll excuse me, I think I should attend to this message. Sherry doesn't track me down unless it's something urgent.
Sure, I understand. Maybe we could continue this conversation at another time. Why do we keep getting interrupted just when I'm going to talk to Dr. Murphy about the danger he is in? It's almost like some force is fighting against me.
Stephanie sat there watching Murphy walk away. She then looked at the verse he had written down for her. I have learned the secret of contentment in every situation, whether it be a full stomach or hunger, plenty or want. For I can do everything God asks me to with the help of Christ, who gives me the strength and power. Philippians 4:12-13. Chapter 21.
Boy, you're in trouble now, Sherry said with a smirk as Murphy entered the office.
Murphy chuckled. With that smirk on her face and her black pigtails, she was a sight to behold. Sherry definitely had her own unique style.
Trouble? There's a note on your desk. Dean Archer Falworth wants to see you in his office at 11 a.m. He sounded a little upset on the phone.
Do you know what it's about?
He didn't say. All he wanted me to do was to make sure that you got the message. He's probably jealous that so many students are taking your class in biblical archaeology. I think he's wound a little too tight.
Murphy could feel his stomach tightening as he approached Falworth's office in the Arts and Science building. Their working relationship had not been an easy one.
I wonder what he's going to complain about this time.
Falworth glanced up from his desk as Murphy entered. Falworth's hand trembled slightly as he tried to keep his facial expression under control.
I want to talk to you about your class, he said curtly. I understand that you are pushing religion on your students again.
Murphy could feel his temper beginning to simmer.
I'm not quite sure if I understand what you mean. I am teaching a course in biblical archaeology, and we discuss religious topics in the process. It's part of the curriculum. My sources suggest that you are using your course to push your one-sided views about Christianity. I understand that you are talking against Arabs and putting down other religions. I don't know where you're getting your information, Archer, but it's wrong. I share facts and details about many forms of ancient worship, from Babylonian gods to Greek mythology to Christianity. The students are presented with information and its relationship to archaeology and history. I haven't put down anyone. Don't you talk about Christianity more than the other religions? Of course I do, Archer. It's a course in biblical archaeology. I think that you're coming across bigoted and intolerant of other people's views. Wait a minute.
Both of Murphy's feet were firmly planted on the floor and he was leaning forward. Just how do you define tolerance? Murphy could see Falworth's neck beginning to get red.
Tolerance is respecting other people's viewpoints and holding them on an equal level with your viewpoints. You should give them equal time to share their concepts and not be judgmental of someone else's beliefs or behaviors.
Well, that sounds good and politically correct, Archer, but that's not what tolerance means, according to the dictionary. Part of what you're saying is true, yes, we should respect the right of other people to believe what they desire. Not everyone believes the same thing, but I don't have to put what another person believes on the same level as what I believe. That would make truth relative and not absolute. Truth is relative. Is it really? If an Arab terrorist or a Russian terrorist or a terrorist from any country blows up innocent children in a school, you're saying that I should hold his beliefs, values, and behaviors on the same level as mine when I think life is sacred? And because I don't hold and endorse his beliefs on the same level, I'm judgmental and intolerant? That's not how it works.
That's a good example of what I mean. Look at what you've just done. You have racially profiled terrorists. I think that you're phobic against Arabs and Russians.
Whoa, just a minute, Archer. Because I have strong opinions and convictions that differ from what you believe, that makes me phobic? Is that the game? When I have a different viewpoint, you begin to call me names.
By now, both Murphy and Falworth were standing.
You're fanatically phobic on certain issues, Falworth exclaimed.
Murphy quashed his desire to suggest that they go outside to settle the issue.
Get control, Murphy. Don't escalate it any more. A soft answer turns away wrath.
He took a deep breath. I used Arab and Russian terrorists as an illustration. It was not a put-down of particular groups of people. Those examples are current on television and in the newspapers. You don't read about Eskimo or Polynesian terrorists, do you? I think that tolerance and political correctness have become twisted. Disagreement with someone's beliefs and behaviors is not intolerance. It is discernment and conviction. If we didn't have that, we would have everyone thinking the same way.
That would be nice for a change rather than your bigoted opinions.
And who determines which way to think or believe, Archer? Is it you? If anyone disagrees with you, do we then call out the thought police and put them in jail? If we are to hold everyone's beliefs and behaviors on the same level and become tolerant and accepting of them, why don't you hold my opinions on the same level as yours? Why aren't you tolerant of them? Why must I give up what I believe and only approve what you believe in? Don't you see a double standard here? Isn't Preston University a place where ideas are shared and free speech is allowed?
Of course free speech is allowed, but not hate speech, not fanaticism.
I think you've lost it, Archer. Having convictions, values, and moral standards does not equal fanaticism.
That's the point. You think you have a corner on truth. You're not sensitive to other people's feelings, nor are you being inclusive of their beliefs.
Murphy could see that they were just going in a circle, so he reverted to his usual tactic when frustrated and under verbal attack. He asked a question.
So what's the bottom line, Archer? What do you want from me?
I want your hate speech to end. Your conservative, right-wing, phobic, fundamentalist beliefs are disruptive to this university. Christianity should be saved for church. It has no place in the classroom.
Let me follow your logic. You're equating hate speech with Christianity, and it's okay to use hate speech in the church, but not in the classroom. Am I to assume that you don't see your views as hate speech toward the ideas and beliefs of Christians?
Falworth ignored the question.
Murphy, I'd like to see your idiotic archaeology class removed from the school curriculum entirely.
Well, Archer, I have about 150 students who are excited about the class. I don't hear any of them complaining about it. The only complaints come from you, and you haven't attended any of my lectures recently. So much for intellectual honesty.
Do you know who you are talking to?
Yes, I think so. I think I'm talking to a person who had a bad religious experience at some time in his life and is hurt and angry about it. Or maybe you have some moral issues that you are struggling with. It's been my experience that when emotions are out of control for the event going on, something else is going on. We're through talking, Murphy. Just remember what I said. Your job may depend upon it. Is that a threat, Archer?
Chapter 22. Murphy and Isis were seated at a window table in the Pierre, overlooking Central Park, awaiting Levy Abrams. Murphy could not take his eyes off Isis. She was stunning. Her long red hair seemed to shimmer like spun gold. Being with such a beautiful woman almost took his breath away. His heart raced as Isis looked across the table at him and smiled. Murphy glanced out the window, trying to rein in his emotions. He could see the pond, the Woman Memorial Rink, magnificent trees, and the lights of the city twinkling on the other side of the park. Isis spoke softly.
There's something lovely about New York in the evening, isn't there?
You're right. I think that since 9/11, when the World Trade Center was destroyed, everyone looks a little differently at the city now. It sort of brought everyone together.
Isis focused on Murphy for a moment, watching him gaze out the window. He had a handsome, rugged quality about him. He was decisive and straightforward, no pretense at all. He was positive, full of life, and always seeking adventure. He was short on patience and strong on opinions, but she had grown to appreciate his candor and openness. It was infinitely better than some of the other men she had dated, who had no opinions or convictions about anything. Murphy glanced up and caught Isis looking at him. Something in her eyes, in her whole being, unnerved him. He was trying to think of something to say when he heard a voice.
"So, what are you lovebirds up to?"
Murphy felt a twinge of embarrassment at Levy Abrams' words. He hadn't shared his growing feelings for Isis openly with her yet. Murphy stood, and the men hugged and clapped each other on the back. Then Abrams bent down and kissed Isis on the cheek.
"My, my, but you do look lovely tonight. Michael, I'm glad we could get together. This is a fine spot. It has been a couple of years since I have eaten here."
Fadil stood in the shadows, shaking nervously as he watched the street. Nothing seemed strange or out of place. He looked over at the window of Aladdin's magic carpet and could see a few people sitting at tables eating dinner. He glanced at his watch, then cautiously crossed the street and entered. The dim lights made it hard to see who was in the restaurant. The scent of curry filled the air. Fadil made his way to the back and saw familiar faces. He nodded slightly to them and sat down.
Asim was the first to speak.
"I'm glad you could all make it tonight. I have received a coded email from Abdul Rahim Makar. He has instructed us to ready ourselves."
"You mean that we no longer have to be sleeping warriors?"
Ibrahim asked, excited.
"When does our leader want us to strike?"
"Soon, very soon. The infidel dogs will again face the terror of Allah. They thought 9/11 was bad. Won't they be surprised?"
Fadil's voice trembled when he spoke.
"Will it be in the morning or in the night?"
Asim looked around and lowered his voice.
"It will be in the morning, when the infidels are going to work. Will you be able to disrupt the power grid?"
Fadil nodded.
"Good. I have been informed that the devices are on the way," Asim said. "Most of their security is in the airports, train stations, and government buildings. We will catch them off guard and hurt them greatly."
Everyone lifted his glass.
"To the death!" "That was a wonderful meal, Michael. And to be in the company of such a beautiful lady, too. I'm doubly blessed," Abrams said.
They all laughed.
"Michael, tell me about your crazy idea to go back to Babylon."
Abrams turned serious now. "I told you about my encounter with Methuselah and the ancient plaster."
"It was at least 2,500 years old," Isis explained. "I ran the carbon dating test on it in the Parchments of Freedom Laboratories."
"I think that Methuselah has found Nebuchadnezzar's handwriting on the wall and has given us clues to find it. Could you make arrangements to get us into Iraq?"
I might be able to. Do you remember Colonel Davis of the U.S. Marines?
You mean the one with the bone-crushing handshake?
Yes, he's the one. I was told he's still overseeing the guarding of Babylon. I think I can pull some strings. But don't you want to take someone else with you besides just the two of you?
Who were you thinking of?
Your friend, Jassim Amram, the professor of archaeology at the American University in Cairo. He's an expert in Arab culture and identifying ancient artifacts. I think he'd be of great help to you.
That's a good idea, Levy. And he's the sonar sled expert. Using it can speed up the search process. I think I know about where the spot should be, but sonar would help pinpoint it. I'll call him tomorrow, check his availability, and have him find out about the sonar sled.
I'll email Colonel Davis and get permission. Do you have funding yet?
We're still working on that, Isis replied. The Foundation is excited about the possibility of such a find.
There was a slight pause.
Levy, how about your business? Have you gotten the information you came to New York for?
Murphy knew that he wouldn't be able to discuss details.
Well, let's just say that we are following up on rumors that an important transaction is about to take place.
In New York?
We're not sure, but there is a strong possibility. I'll be following up on some details here for the next couple of days, and then I'm off to Texas, Abrams said.
Texas? What are you men talking about? Isis asked, a questioning look on her face.
Just men talk, Abrams said as he looked at his watch. I'm sorry, but I must run. I need to catch a cab. I have a late appointment this evening.
No need for that, Murphy told him. I have a rental car. I'll give you a lift.
That would be great, Michael. Let me go make a phone call, and then we can leave.
What was that all about? Isis asked when Abrams had left.
Terrorists. It sounds like Levy's group, Murphy raised his eyebrows, is getting information that there may be another bomb attack in New York.
Why then is he going to fly to Texas?
My guess is that something is going to be smuggled across the Mexican border. It's almost impossible to guard without the National Guard. Rumors are that Mexico is the favorite route for terrorists to enter the United States these days. After they arrive, some go into what's called sleeper cells, awaiting orders to strike predetermined targets in the United States.
You got all that from his conversation?
No, not tonight's. I know quite a bit about Levy.
Murphy lowered his voice.
I think he's an undercover agent for Mossad here in the States. That's how he's so well connected.
Are we talking about spy activities?
You might say that. I'm just glad he's on the side of the good guys. I'll drop you off at the hotel first, then I'll take Levy to meet his friends.
Isis looked worried.
Michael, I want you to be careful, she said softly.
Murphy hesitated for a moment, then reached across the table and took her hand in his. He was about to make a joking comment, but could tell from her look that it would be inappropriate. He smiled and spoke gently.
I'll be fine. I'll be very careful. I want us to have many more conversations together.
Isis smiled, yet she felt a twinge of fear deep inside. Chapter 23 Murphy drove north and then turned east on 62nd Street to the FDR Drive.
Michael, take the toll bridge over to Randall's Island Park and then Highway 278 into the Bronx. I need to meet my contact near Hunts Point Market.
Murphy had been to Hunts Point on one other occasion, on the way to the Bronx Zoo with some friends. They wanted him to see one of the largest food distribution centers in the United States. He remembered them saying that it provided produce and meat for more than 15 million people. Tons of food were loaded and unloaded in the teeming market each day. It was a rough-and-tumble place. Many of the men who worked in the market were not the type you'd want to meet in a dark alley. Murphy remembered seeing just about every nationality possible working side by side.
It would be easy for a terrorist to disappear into that crowd, he recognized.
Abrams broke into his thoughts.
Did you know that a number of famous people came from the Bronx?
I know that Yankee Stadium is there. I've been to a number of games.
Oh, yes, but people who came from the Bronx, Regis Philbin, Carl Reiner, and even Colin Powell. I met him in Israel.
When was that? Asked Murphy.
When he was head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I also heard that the movie actors James Caan and Tony Curtis, along with Bobby Darin, the singer, and Ralph Lauren, the designer and perfume guy, lived there. I think Al Pacino and Neil Simon came from the Bronx, too.
You're a walking trivia book, Levy. Do you have any trivia on the business acquaintances you're looking for? Abrams hesitated for a moment.
Michael, turn there at the next corner.
Murphy could tell that his friend wanted to change the subject.
Michael, slow down now. Turn off your lights and pull over to the curb.
Murphy followed Abrams' request without question.
See the old car in the next block?
The one in front of the old tenement house?
Yes, that's Jacob. Quickly, turn the dome light on and off.
Murphy did as requested and then waited. After 30 seconds, the brake lights of the old car flashed on and off.
We can approach, Abrams explained. After I find out what's happening, you can go back to the hotel, Michael.
Together, they walked the block to the old car and got in the back seat.
Who is that, Levy?
Jacob asked. This is my friend, Michael Murphy. You can speak freely in front of him. He can be trusted. What have you learned?
There are about 7 of them, Jacob said. We have the first names of 3, and we're working on the other 4. There is a short, stocky man with a dark mustache. His name is Asim. He looks like a short Saddam. We think he's their leader. There is a tall, thin man named Fadil. He seems to be a very nervous type. The other one is Ibrahim. I think he has a short fuse. He is a very intense person, a true zealot.
Have you discovered anything about their plans? Asked Abrams.
We intercepted an email to Asim. It was from Abdul Rahid Makar.
Makar?
Yes, the number 2 man in the movement. He's very powerful and demands absolute loyalty. He rules with a strong hand. One of our informants told us that he held a party for his wife and invited his friends. One of those in attendance had stolen a small amount of money from him some time before.
Let me guess, he cut off the man's hand.
No. He cut off the man's head, right in front of everyone. He's a very evil man.
What did the email say?
We're still trying to decode it, but we're pretty sure that it is telling them to get ready for a significant attack. We don't know where or when, but it sounds as if it will be soon. It seems to indicate New York.
That makes sense. It would be a great boost for their movement if they could get through the security defenses a second time. Where's Matthew?
Around the corner in the car, watching the back entrance.
Let's get him.
As Abrams, Jacob, and Murphy approached, they could see a man who seemed to be focused on something in front of the car. When Abrams tapped on the driver's window, the man didn't move.
Something's wrong,
Abrams exclaimed, pulling the door wide. Matthew's eyes were open, but Abrams knew instantly that he was dead. But why was he sitting straight up? Jacob opened the back door.
Levy. He's been stabbed.
Murphy looked over Jacob's shoulder. Someone must have been in the back seat and run a long knife through the seat and into the man's back. The knife held him in an upright position. Abrams and Jacob closed the doors and wiped their fingerprints off the door handles.
Are you just going to leave him there? Murphy asked.
Michael, this is the sad part of our business, Abrams explained somberly. We must leave our friend there. He's undercover and has no identification on him. We cannot remain here for the police or any other agency to find us. We all know the price when we join.
We've got to move quickly, Jacob exclaimed. We can't wait for them to launch an attack. We must stop them before they do something.
Do you know where they are?
They live on the 5th floor on the end where the light is.
Abrams turned to Murphy.
You must leave. You cannot be found with us. It's too dangerous.
There's 2 of you and 7 of them, and you're asking me to leave? No way. I'm going with you.
You're not armed.
I'll take my chances.
Even as he said that, Murphy could recall Isis's worried look. He had promised her he would be careful. It only took them a couple of minutes to get to the 5th floor. They approached the door quietly, then paused and listened. They could hear a television playing. Jacob opened his jacket and took out a set of lockpicks. Slowly, he inserted them. Within a few seconds, there was a click, and the men froze.
Abrams drew his gun and whispered,
I don't think they heard it. Let's wait a moment and then go in.
Jacob nodded, put away the picks, and drew his automatic. Both of them screwed on silencers.